So in the past 9 months or so, there's been considerable progress in understanding the string theory microstates of an ordinary Kerr black hole. So this is mostly based on a couple of papers, one that I wrote with Roberto Amperon last summer, and a very important follow-up paper that Roberto and Macaroni, is that how you pronounce it, wrote just a couple of months ago. I'm also working with Matt Roberts on trying to extend these results even further. Okay, so the starting point is the observation that the entropy of an extremal Kerr black hole is simply given by 2 pi times the absolute value of the angular momentum. Now, the angular momentum is naturally quantized, so this gives one hope that you can, you know, that there'll be a sort of a microstate counting to explain the entropy. And the entropy is also independent of Newton's constant, which suggests that you should be able to count the states at weak coupling and then extrapolate and reproduce this at strong coupling. So that's what we'd like to try to do. Now, in the early days of string theory, many people commented on the fact that the bound on Kerr black holes, so the Kerr bound, which says that if you want to have an event horizon, the angular momentum has to be less than the mass squared. That looked a lot like the bound that was found for perturbative string states. String states were found to also satisfy a bound that the angular momentum was less than the mass squared. So there was lots of talk and discussion about, well, maybe we could understand extremal black holes by looking at maximally spinning strings or something like that. Of course, this is totally wrong. It's wrong because when you put back in the dimensional constants, the Kerr bound says that the angular momentum is less than the mass squared times Newton's constant. And the bound from the sort of leading Reggie trajectory in string theory says the angular momentum is less than the mass squared times alpha prime. Yeah?
You probably also get a different comparison in different dimensions, is that right? It's just a four-dimensional?
Well, this is certainly the four-dimensional bound. In higher dimensions, you have components of the angular momentum in many different directions.
Right, yeah. But presumably, you'd have some dimension dependence.
There could also be the other problems. Yeah. So.
But in particular, if you're looking at a string rotating in a single plane, that bound applies. Whereas for the black hole, it doesn't. In higher dimensions.
In higher dimensions. Yeah.
So there is a discrepancy. Okay. Another discrepancy.
So an extremal Kerr black hole is not to be thought of as a maximally spinning string. That's good news, because there are very few states associated with a maximally spinning string, and we couldn't hope to explain the entropy of Kerr that way. So what the Kerr really is can be seen by looking at this in a slightly different way. You can just say that the mass squared, say for extreme black hole, so on the extremal limit, the mass squared is the angular momentum divided by Newton's constant, and string units, that's g squared l squared, string length squared. Or in other words, the mass is some constant, some integer, divided by g ls. It's a d brain. It's a d0 brain. So in fact, that's the story I'd like to sort of tell you about today. How we can, in fact, explain the entropy of extremal Kerr using D0 brains.
You went into D0 with irrational charge.
You're worried about the 1/2?
Yeah.
Me too. Yeah.
It's not J,
it's, yeah. It's the square root of J. Okay, well, this is supposed to be suggestive, okay? I'm not going to get this. This is motivation. Yes.
Okay.
Well, this is related to both questions. So for a higher dimensional curve, would you remind me, well, would you expect a similar statement to hold that your event grows like 1 over G?
A similar thing holds in five dimensions if you interpret things the right way. So let me first. This is getting a little. It's getting a little bit ahead. I could. Let's see. Let me just tell you this because it'll give you a hint. But I'll develop it more in a minute. So in five dimensions, you might be worried that this doesn't apply, because the five dimensions, you know, Myers-Perry black hole. An extremal limit satisfies a condition which says that gm cubed goes like j squared up to constants, right? So you might say, well, that doesn't look like I'm going to get a 1 over g out of that. But in fact, this is a five-dimensional Newton's constant. And the way this is all going to work out is we're going to be compactifying the fifth direction, viewing it as the m-theory circle. So G5 in string theory is going to be the four-dimensional Newton's constant times the radius. The radius is going to be the m-theory radius, which actually has length g in string units. So this thing will actually be g cubed. And in fact, it will work out that m is equal to 1 over g in this case also.
Okay. Can you say anything about other dimensions too, or not?
No. No. So I'm not getting rotating black holes in all dimensions. What I'm going to be talking mostly about is four- and five-dimensional black holes. Okay. Now, okay, so I said this was suggestive. There will be precise correspondence if you add in a single D6 brain. Okay, so we're going to have to add in a little bit of D6 brains, and then everything actually works out, and we'll get agreements with the entropy and everything. So anyway, so this is sort of the motivation where we want to go. But to sort of develop it properly, I have to take a step back and tell you a bit about black holes and ordinary Kluze-Klein theory. So let's first just talk a little bit about.
So last year there was a lot of work by Strominger and other people involving D0, D2, D6s. So you're just removing D2 brain charge from that point of view.
Right. I'm removing the D2 brain charges. And that, I think, is an important step because they were working with supersymmetric configurations. And all of their discussion had to do with supersymmetric black holes. These black holes are not supersymmetric. Kerr clearly is not supersymmetric.
They're extremal black
holes. Extremal. They're extremal, but still not supersymmetric. And even when we add the D6 brain, these are not going to be supersymmetric. Okay. And there'll be vacuum. So the D6 brain will still be a vacuum solution in higher dimensions, as you know. With the D2 brains, they're not vacuum anymore. Okay, so black holes in five-dimensional, ordinary, simple, five-dimensional Kluze-Klein theory. So as I said, these are vacuum solutions, vacuum black holes in 5D, which asymptotically go to a circle across four-dimensional Minkowski space. If you dimensionally reduce on the circle, they're characterized by four parameters. There is a mass, angular momentum, an electric charge, and magnetic charge coming from the gauge field you get from the dimensional reduction. These parameters satisfy a very strange-looking inequality. You can show that they always satisfy 2gm is bigger than or equal to q to the 2/3 plus p to the 2/3 all to the 3/2. Okay, this is the analog of the usual bound on Reiser-Nordström or charged black holes that the mass must be bigger than or equal to the charge. There are a number of special cases here. If the charges all vanish, if q and p are both zero, then the solutions become simply the product of Kerr and a circle. Kerr cross S1. And if you have equal charges, say q equal to p not equal to 0, but j equal to 0, then these are ordinary Reiser-Nordström black holes. In general, they're not Reiser-Nordström because you have an extra scalar field coming from G55 and it modifies the solution.
Gary,
yeah. J does not arise in the inequality. There is a bound on the mass independent of J. There is also a bound on J. So I'm not putting down, I mean, there's a bound on J as well, which is a complicated function of the other parameters. Okay, there are two types of extremal limits for these rotating black holes. You have a slow rotating regime and a fast rotating regime. So for so in the extremal limit, you have sort of a if the angular momentum is less than the product of the charges, then the black hole actually doesn't rotate in the extremal limit in the sense that the four-dimensional black hole has zero angular velocity and no ergosphere. So the angular velocity of the horizon is zero, and there's no ergosphere. J is not zero, though. It can still be non-zero as long as it's less than this bound. And you should think of the angular momentum as being as arising from the fields outside the black hole. Also in this regime, this inequality is saturated for all J. So the inequality is saturated.
This is related to the fact that a magnetic a charge and a monopole together carry angular momentum or no?
A charge and a monopole together carry angular momentum if they're displaced, and the angular momentum is exactly this, the dividing line here. So this is less than the angular momentum that you would get if you actually separated your charge and your monopole.
How do you think about that difference, the fact that you can get less than QB?
Well, they're sort of, they're not separated, right? They're both inside the horizon sitting inside this black hole.
Okay. What do you get if you separate them? I thought it was a half of QB or something like that.
These are not the integer normalized charges. These are the dimensionful charges. And when we go to the integer normalized charges, this will in fact be one half the product of the integers. Yeah. So these are the dimensionful charges like the charge in Reiser-Nordström. Okay, the other limit is more like Kerr. In this case, the angular velocity is not zero on the horizon. You have an ergosphere. And in the limit when this is much bigger, if they're much bigger than this, the solution is approximately Kerr. Across a circle. Okay? All right. So those are the solutions. These charges, as we were just saying, are quantized. So Q and P are naturally quantized. Q, after all, is just momentum around our fifth direction. So if we periodically identify the fifth direction, say x5 is, say, periodically identified with period r, then the charges, let me just get the factors of 2, not that it matters for anything, but so Q is 2 Newton's constant times an integer n0 divided by r, of course quantized in units of 1 over r. And P is equal to some other integers I'll call n6 times r divided by 4. Yeah?
GJ is much, much bigger than QP is.
Yeah?
This static region must be saturated.
No. No, it's not saturated. So in this case, if you're at the extremal limit, you are strictly above this bound. You don't saturate the bound in this fast rotating regime.
What do you mean by extremality condition?
The extremality condition in this, well, in both cases, is the fact that the temperature of the horizon goes to zero, the surface gravity is zero, and you have a degenerate.
I mean, at this moment, we expect there is a relation between J, Q, P.
There is, and there's a more complicated one which involves J.
What?
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so N0 and N6 are just two integers, which in a moment will be related to zero brains and six brains, but not yet. Right now, they're just two integers. And so what are some of these solutions? Well, if N6 is 0, if you have no monopole charge, then these solutions are just boosted black strings. You take a neutral Schwarzschild. So you take Schwarzschild, 4D Schwarzschild, cross a line and boost along the line. That gives you momentum along the circle. And then you identify, periodically identify to make it into a circle. That gives you a boosted black string. And that's all these black holes with electric charge in Kluze-Klein theory are just these boosted black strings because the charge is just momentum. If N6 is 1, and if you have no angular momentum, no charge, and you're extremal, so if J is 0, Q is 0, you have only this unit magnetic charge and you're extremal, well, this is the famous Kluze-Klein monopole that David and Malcolm Perry and Raphael Sorkin discussed long ago. So that's the solution which doesn't have a horizon. It's nice and smooth and everything. But any other case, if you add some charge, if you add some angular momentum, otherwise you have a horizon, and the horizon is a nice S3. So the circle here combines with the two-sphere, you get a topological three-sphere. So there's a nice way to picture these black holes, which is the following. This Kluze-Klein monopole is really just a product of time and the Euclidean Taub-Nut solution. So the Euclidean Taub-Nut looks like this. You have this circle at infinity, but it smoothly pinches off at some point at the origin. So you can imagine putting a little five-dimensional rotating black hole right at the tip of this Kluze-Klein monopole. So this is a Myers-Perry black hole sitting right there. Now, the charge Q that we've been talking about is just momentum along the circle. But if you take that circle and bring it all the way down to the tip, it's just one of the directions that this black hole can rotate in. A black hole in five dimensions can rotate in two different orthogonal planes. So in fact, this Myers-Perry black hole has two angular momentum, J1 and J2. And they carry the same information as Q and J, the four-dimensional angular momentum that I've been describing over there. And the way it works out is that Q is related or basically equal to the sum of the angular momentum in the two different orthogonal planes, and J is the difference.
So
this is a 4D-5D connection. Right? This is a 4D-5D connection, which is very similar to what was discussed by Diago and Schrödinger and all those people in the supersymmetric case. And all we're doing is noticing that exactly the same thing works for the non-supersymmetric case with neutral black holes. You put them at the tip and you can still make this correspondence. You just don't have D0 charges. D2 brain charges to worry about anymore. Okay. So now you can do the following. You can let's look at the extremal limit. I guess that's the next thing to do here. The entropy in the extremal limit for these Kluze-Klein black holes takes the following form. So entropy in the extremal limit it's 2 pi times the square root of n0 squared and 6 squared over 4 minus j squared. And this is in the slow rotating case. So the when you translate to these integer normalized charges, you'll see that qp over g is just n0 and 6 over 2. So this is the slow rotating case where j is less than n0 and 6 over 2. And in the fast rotating case, it's just the opposite way around, j squared. For large angular momentum. Now, you notice that this is totally independent of the size of the fifth direction. The entropy is once again a function just of integer normalized quantities, these number of charges, fundamental charges, and angular momentum. It's independent of r. And you can use this to now make an argument that you can interchange q for j. What we're really interested in, if we want to understand Kerr or things like Kerr, is the fast rotating case. So I want to claim that you can interchange, for the standpoint of understanding entropy, you can interchange j with q. As follows. Let's start with the case where q is 0 and j is not 0. So we just take j2 equal to minus j1. Start with sort of j not equal to 0 and q equal to 0. We now take the radius, very big. That doesn't change the entropy, and what it does is it gives us a ordinary Myers-Perry black hole. So we get a Myers-Perry black hole with J1 equal to minus J2. Now, a Myers-Perry black hole with J1 equal to minus J2 is geometrically identical to one with J1 equal to plus J2. All you do is a reflection, right? You basically change phi to minus phi. And you change the sign of the angular momentum. You're doing nothing more geometrically to the black hole than that. In some sense, it's a convention of which way you're choosing to rotate. So now you just reflect. So you get J1 equal to J2. And now you shrink R again. Well, so what we've done, when at large R, there's no difference. These black holes are both five-dimensional Myers-Perry black holes. Just one's a reflection of the other. But when you now shrink R, you see that you have now put all that rotation into this fifth direction and not into the non-compact directions. So you end up with a Kaluza-Klein black hole with J equal to 0. And q not equal to 0. So this suggests that if we understand the charged case, we will understand the rotating case.
So is there any subtlety here when there are these six planes around? And I ask that only because your entropy formulas don't look symmetric under n0 and interchanging n0 and j.
Let's see. The okay, so n6 does come in here. There are factors of n6 which make it work. So I guess in writing this, the connection between, yeah, I think there's a factor of n6 in one of these formulas which makes it work.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. It does work, right? I mean, it's clear geometrically it has to work. And the only reason it doesn't look right if n6 is not 1 is because I didn't put the factors of n6 in here. So there is.
There's a factor of 2 as well.
And there's a factor of 2 as well, right. Yeah. Okay. Well, so now we've sort of reduced the problem to something we can solve, because this is exactly what Roberto and I did last summer, is find a way to count the states of charged, well, of Kaluza-Klein black holes with Q and P, but Okay, so how did we do that? Well, we want to embed this in string theory. So you first of all so we take the product of these five-dimensional black holes with a six torus. So we get a solution to M-theory, and we view the Kaluza-Klein circle as the M-theory circle. We can take, I believe you can replace the six torus with a Calabi-Yau. We've not worked it out in detail in that case. And this is something I probably should talk to you or David about, because you'll see in a minute that a crucial role is played by three T-dualities in this. And the three T-dualities are what we usually sort of in Calabi-Yau language think of as just a mirror symmetry. So there should be a description of all of this for Calabi-Yau compactifications, where when I come to the three T-dualities in a minute, it's just, you know, looking at the mirror.
Yeah, it sounds good, because I would like T6 to be favored in favor of Calabi-Yaus, because I would imagine that in some regime, this D0, D6 black holes could be described as their microstates would correspond to ground states in the quantum mechanics of D0 brains. And that would be cohomology of some symmetric product of the six manifold, and dance should not be really sensitive to the topology, so it should be some specific six manifold. So six torus sounds like a good choice.
Well, maybe we should talk more about this and see if there's some. I mean, we really took just the six torus case because that was the sort of simplest one to analyze. So you view the Kaluza-Klein circle as the M-theory circle. You know that the size of the circle, as I said earlier, is related to the string coupling in this way. The electric charge Q, which is momentum in the circle, is just the D0 brain charge. And the magnetic charge P is just the D6 brain charge. And as I said before, N0 and N6 are just the number of brains. You can write the formula we had for the mass, that funny formula involving the charges to the 2/3 and 3/2 and everything, in terms of the number of brains. So if you write down just the mass of the brains, the mass of sort of the brains given by the usual formula, so we have the mass of the 0 brain is just 1 over g ls. The mass of the 6 brain wrapped over the 6 torus is going to be the volume of the 6 torus divided by GLS. And then it turns out that the bound on the mass, or in fact the then the mass must be, well, in our case where we're not looking at the fast rotating case now, we're looking at the slow rotating case, or even the case without any angular momentum, is just equal to the number of 0 brains, the mass of the 0 brains to the 2/3, plus the number of 6 brains, mass of the 6 brains to the 2/3, all equal to, all raised to the 3/2 power. So we want to understand that mass formula and the entropy in the slow rotating case. In fact, I've argued we can set J to 0, so then it becomes particularly simple. with J equal to 0, the entropy is just pi n0 n6. Okay? So these are the sort of results we'd like to, that I basically obtained from the black holes. We'd like to reproduce that from some sort of bound states of 0 brains and 6 brains. Okay, but before I do that, let me just remind you of what was done in counting states of supersymmetric black holes. So this is just a slight digression to recall a couple formulas. For four-dimensional supersymmetric black holes, okay, so these had their entropy counted back in 1996. First of all, it was realized that to get a four-dimensional supersymmetric black hole, you need four different types of brains, or four different types of charges. So you need four different charges. There are many different possible choices. They're related by various dualities. The one that's going to be convenient for us here is one which involves four different stacks of D3 brains. So you can take four stacks of D3 brains. And the rules are that to get a supersymmetric configuration, you need to have these stacks arranged so that any two intersect over a line. And all four intersect over a point. If you look at this configuration of intersecting brains, it turns out you have a choice of orientation on each brain. You can choose the orientations arbitrarily on the first three. So you can choose any orientation you want for three of the brains, and then supersymmetry tells you the orientation you need for the last one. Okay, so that's what...
If you look at the local configuration, locally switches is globally switches locally, if you choose the bad last one.
If you choose the bad one...
Locally switches preserved, but globally. Globally broken, but locally switches preserved.
Locally, you mean near the point?
Yeah, it does. Right. If you look at the arbitrary, suppose we choose a bad one and the last one.
Yeah.
And globally switches broken, as you said.
Right.
If you look at the arbitrary two, and then she is two.
Oh, yeah. Any two, you won't see it. Right. I just said you can choose the orientation arbitrarily on three of them. So if you look at only two of them, you don't see that supersymmetry is broken. In fact, that tells you that there's no tachyons in the string. So we have, so we're wrapping. We have a six torus here. I want to think of the six torus as a product of two tori. So think of this as T2 cubed. And these brains, there are three brains, and so they have three dimensions. They wrap one cycle on each of these T2s, and in this case, they're wrapping just the fundamental cycle, either that one or this one. Okay, so that's the three brains we're thinking about. And indeed, I mean, a string has two endpoints, so it only connects two brains. And since any two brains could be part of a supersymmetric configuration, you know there's not any instabilities, any perturbative tachyons in this case, even though, as you say, globally the supersymmetry is broken. Okay. So this is a supersymmetric case. You could put different numbers of brains in the different stacks, but we won't bother with that. We'll just take the simple case where all of them have the same. So if each stack has n brains, then it turns out you can write down the supergravity solution corresponding to this. And the supergravity solution in the case when you have the same number of brains in each stack is simply a product of Reiser-Nordström, extreme Reiser-Nordström. So the black hole is extreme Reiser-Nordström across a six torus. So all the moduli of the torus are constant. In this case, it becomes particularly simple. And the mass turns out to be a 4n times V3. So I said let's take these tori to be T2s. We might as well take each T2 to be square. So they have the same radius, but they can have different radii among the brains if we want. So this can be R3, R3, and R5, and R5. Doesn't matter. We could take them all the same if you want. But then this volume, this V3, is the volume of a 3 brain. So we'll take V3 to be is just the product of the 3 radii, R1, R3, and R5. So it's this divided by G in string units. Now that turns out to be the mass you calculate from the Reiser-Nordström black hole, but of course it's also exactly the mass of these brains. You have 4 stacks of brains, each having n brains in each stack, so those are 4 n brains. The mass of each 3 brain is the volume V3 that it wraps, divided by G in string units. The entropy, well, again, you can do the calculation from the black hole side. The black hole entropy turns out to be 2 pi n squared, just from the Hawking-Bekenstein formula. And when people counted the states, actually, the counting is not so easy in this particular realization of the charges in terms of 4 different stacks of D3 brains, but that's U-dual to a different configuration in which one of the charges is momentum, and you have some D2 brains and D4 brains and things like that, D6 brains. So when you do the counting, so the brain entropy is, in general, 2 pi times the square root of the product of the charges, I guess the integer charges. That's the general formula you get. But when all the charges are equal and equal to n, that clearly agrees. OK, so that's just a reminder of what happened for the supersymmetric case. And I guess I should also mention that since the entropy is independent of all the moduli, right, it only depends on these integer charges, it's natural to think of it as associated with this common intersection point of all the D3 brains. That's where the states must lie. OK, so now let's return to the case at hand. And what was that? Well, we had argued that our sort of black holes we wanted to understand, these Kaluza-Klein black holes with electric and magnetic charges, were mapped into string theory into these states of D0 and D6 brain charge. So we want to count bound states of D0 brains and D6 brains. Now, you might think there aren't any, because it's known that D0 brains and D6 brains repel each other. At far distance, they repel each other. At short distance, they repel each other. That may not appear to have any bound states. There are D6 bound states. But in fact, Waddy Taylor showed, about 1997, that this isn't the case. He considered, Waddy considered 4 D6 brains. So he had a U4 gauge theory on the D6 brain. And he found bound states of dissolved, sort of non-localized D0 brains by finding a gauge configuration, sort of a configuration of this U4 gauge field, with the property that if you took the trace of F integrated over any 2 cycle, you got 0. If you took the trace of F wedge F integrated over any four cycle, you got 0. But the integral of the trace of F wedge F wedge F was not 0. And so this tells you that this configuration doesn't have any D4 brain charge, doesn't have any D2 brain charge, but does have D0 brain charge. And in fact, if with the normalization, you find that the number of D0 brains he gets is 4 also. OK, so this says there was some bound states of D0 brains and D4 brains.
Bound because the energy in this configuration saturates BDS bound or something?
No. No. Okay. These break supersymmetry. The energy of this configuration is strictly above the energy you would get if you took these zero brains and six brains and separated them. So it's consistent with the idea that there's a repulsive force between them. You have to add energy to get them together. But Wadi also studied the stability of this. You might say, well, in that case, why don't they just fly apart? And he showed that these are stable. Just to classical Yang-Mills perturbations, they're stable. The quadratic, linearized perturbations are stable.
So they may, over long time scales, tunnel off to some large
section. Absolutely. And we expect they do, because these extreme Reiser-Nordström black holes are also unstable to Hawking radiation over long time scales. They are extremal. They have zero Hawking temperature. But they, the individual D0 brains, you can check, have a charge bigger than the mass in the right units. And so that this is the case where you can actually decharge yourself. That's not surprising. If you go to the five-dimensional picture, if you let R become big and ask what's happening, these are just rotating five-dimensional black holes, and they have ergospheres in five dimensions. And so we know that these extremal rotating black holes can lose energy from super radiant scattering.
Even more than that, they can lose energy from just quantum radiation angular.
Right. Super radiant means you throw in something.
Right.
So even if you don't throw in anything, quantum mechanics, this was the first type of black hole radiation Starobinsky or somebody discussed even before Hawking did the Schwarzschild case. Yeah, yeah. And that made sense because they thought of the Kerr black hole as an excited state of Schwarzschild, and they had energy in the rotation, so that was being quantum mechanically released, and they thought Schwarzschild would be stable, but it's not. Okay.
Zeldovich,
yeah, that was my meaning.
Now, perform the bound state of the 36 would be to add a B field. Is it related to this work or not?
You know, we thought a little bit about adding a B field, and I don't see the connection. This is going to give us everything we need, and when we try to add a B field, we don't seem to get anything we need, at least nothing we need.
Did you realize the configuration for the three brains, but can you end up with a D36 and a B field on the...
We're getting there right now. Wadi Taylor, in addition to pointing out that you have this bound state of four D0 brains and four D6 brains, also did three T-dualities on this configuration. So he basically, you T-dualize on, say, R1, R3, and R5. And what he showed is that this configuration turns into four D3 brains in a configuration very much like this, except now the brains wrap diagonals of the torus. So you get four D3 brains sort of like the supersymmetric, but wrapping the diagonals. Now, this at first sight looks surprising. You have four different D3 brains. Each one wraps a diagonal. So when you wrap a diagonal, that's like introducing two charges, right? A single string would sort of give you a charge here and a charge over that cycle. And so if you have four stacks of brains and they all wrap diagonals, you would think that you have lots of charges. So you would naively expect sort of charges associated with lots of different three cycles, sort of with lots of three cycles here. But in fact, you can check that this particular configuration has only two non-zero charges. Almost all of them cancel, so you actually get there are only two charges wrapping. So the 1-3-5 cycle has a non-zero charge, has charge 4. Each brain contributes 1 to that cycle. There's no cancellation. And the 2-4-6 cycle also has charge 4, because each brain contributes 1 and there's no cancellation. Any other possible 3 cycle, like 1-4-6 or 2-3-5 or something, you can check the charges all cancel. And what's going on is very much like what you would see if you actually took a two torus and took two strings. So now, you know, this is what you see is what you get. So think of this as an actual two torus, and these are actual strings. So you look at that, and you say, what are the non-zero charges? Well, even though you have two strings wrapping diagonals, it's clear that there is no net charge around that one cycle, because these charges cancel, and you get two a net charge around that cycle, because they each contribute one. Okay, so it's just that's the sort of thing which is going on here. Okay, so you can now just put n brains in each of these stacks and see what you get. If you put n brains in each stack, then the charge, if you go back to, so this corresponds to having n0 before n. The charge around the 1-3-5 cycle is now 4 times n. The charge around the 2-4-6 cycle, n6, is 4n. And the mass is just, from the brain side, it's just coming from the fact that the brains are now have a bigger volume than they had before. So the mass of the brains is equal to the mass you had before. Let me just call that m, I'll call it m naught or something. Here it is. So let me call this m0, the original supersymmetric mass. And it's increased just by the fact that these brains are wrapping the diagonal. So since these two tori are square, you get a factor of the square root of 2 for each leg. So you get a factor of 2 to the 3/2. And I claim that's exactly what you get from the black hole side. This is the mass of the black hole, because in this case, where you have equal number of brains, these two terms are equal, and you just get a factor of 2 to the 3/2 from the black hole side. Okay, what about the entropy? So the entropy of the black hole is equal to pi times n0 n6. That was our formula that we started with. If you plug in the charges, we have 4n for n0, 4n for n6. This gives 16 pi n squared. Now, if you look at the brains, the idea is that since the supersymmetric entropy gave us 2 pi n squared for the supersymmetric configuration, and we argued that it should be associated with the common intersection point of the 4 stacks of brains, that shouldn't change when you rotate and have the brains wrap the diagonal. So the brain entropy looks like it's 2 pi n squared, and it looks like we're off by a factor of 8. But in fact, we're not. And the reason is that you have to count the number of intersections. When you wrap diagonals, on each two torus, the brains intersect twice. There's the one you see and the one you don't see, which is the fact that all of these corners are, of course, identified. Okay, so each two torus gives you 2 intersections. The 3 tori in T6 end up giving you 8 intersections. So this is times the number of intersections. And so that's 16. Okay. Yeah.
Can you get away from n0 equals n6?
Yes. Next, n0 not equal to n6. That was exactly the next thing I was going to say. You can get away. I don't know how to derive general n0 and n6, but you can certainly generalize this in a way which is interesting. So let's suppose that n0 is 4n times some arbitrary integer cubed. So If n0 is 4nk cubed, and n6 is 4n, say, little n cubed, then this corresponds to, again, an identical configuration, four stacks of three brains, say, each with n brains in each stack. But now, they don't wrap diagonals. They wrap more general cycles. And so what you have to do is you take your three brains, and wrap sort of a cycles where, say, x2 is plus or minus. Well, it probably doesn't matter which way I put it, but let me just take one of them. Yeah. Okay, so it's equal to k x1 over n. So these are cycles in which, in one fundamental cycle, x1 is wrapped n times, wrapped sort of n times, and x2 is wrapped k times. Okay, so they're just more general things. And, whoops, I guess let me leave this up for another minute. Because we want to check that we get both the mass and the entropy by that simple change in the brain configuration. I should say that the gauge theory analog of this, the change in sort of Waddy's configuration to get Q not equal to N0 not equal to N6, had already been written down. I think Finn Larson did it, and a paper by Dar and Mandel, I think, also did it. So we just sort of did the t-duality of that and realized that this was a simple change. So the idea is that you now have, you know, brains which are doing something like this. Wrapping these more general cycles. So what happens? Well, first of all, the mass of the brains is just the Pythagorean theorem, right? We have x1 is wrapped n times, x2 is wrapped k times. So this is clearly n squared plus k squared to the 1/2 for each leg. But it's a three brain, and each leg is the same size. So the total volume is increased by that to the 3/2. And other than that, everything goes through as before. So we get this times the supersymmetric mass we had before. But this is also what you get from the black hole. Because if you look at this, you get n0 to the 2/3. Well, n0 to the 2/3 just gives you a factor of k squared. And n6 to the 2/3 gives you a factor of n squared. And the whole thing is raised to the 3/2. And then you have what you had before. And so, in fact, the mass comes out exactly right, even for these unequal charges. What about the entropy? Well, the entropy is also OK if you take, so let's take the number of intersections. So that's what we have to make we have to count. We have wrapping more general cycles. We've introduced a lot more intersections. So if you count up how many intersections you have, in this case, it's not 2 anymore. It's 2 times k times n. So you have 2 kn intersections per T2. So that means that the total number of intersections, so the brain entropy, is 2 kn cubed, total number of intersections on the 6th torus, times the entropy per intersection, which was just 2 pi n squared. And you can easily rewrite that as pi times, what is it? It's 4 n k cubed times 4 n cubed, which is the black hole entropy. That's pi n0 n6. Okay. So we get exact agreement between the black hole entropy and the mass for arbitrary charges. Now, okay, so we're interested in the case where Q is much bigger than P. We want to have a lot of electric charge, a little bit of magnetic charge, because the electric charge, remember, is going to be mapped back into angular momentum, and the magnetic charge is just a crutch. I mean, I don't really want magnetic charge if my ultimate goal is to explain Kerr, but I seem stuck with it at the moment to sort of, you know, make this whole story work. So I want to add as little bit of magnetic charge as possible, and the question is, what's the smallest amount we can do? Well, clearly, we don't want to add any more than necessary, so we would take n equal to 1. Here, little n equal to 1, we can make k very big, so we can clearly get large ratios. But now, what about this capital N? You know, we seem to be stuck with a lot of n6 just to get these formulas to make sense. But now we can use another property of black holes, these Kaluza-Klein black holes, which is that you can change n6 without changing the geometry. You see, what's n6? You have this picture with your sort of Myers-Perry black hole sitting at the tip of Taub Nut. A simple quotient, if you take this geometry and quotient, so this is the sort of n6 equal to 1 Kaluza-Klein black hole modded by Zn, okay, gives you a black hole with magnetic charge n. So this increases n6 by n. Now, if we were doing this without the black hole, if this was really just the Kaluza-Klein monopole, then this generates one of these ALE singularities at the tip. It's been well studied in string theory. It's a singularity, like a conical singularity in general relativity. String theory perfectly fine. Strings don't care. And they go right through. But it's even better when you put the black hole there, because now you have a finite area horizon. And this quotient, you know, just acts smoothly on the horizon. So it reduces the area. It changes the size of the circle in the right way. But it doesn't make any conical singularities or any singularities of any kind.
It just doesn't change the topology either.
Doesn't change the topology. It does change the topology in the sense that if you count a winding number,
yeah,
right, for the circle over the base, then n basically is the winding number.
It also changes the topology of the horizon, right?
That's what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. So the topology becomes S3 mod Zn.
So they're not just Myers-Perry black holes anymore.
They are not Myers-Perry black holes. That is correct. They are Myers-Perry black holes with a quotient. Okay. But I want to argue that, you know, as a gravitational physicist, you know, black holes big, you know, take the quotient, take the covering space, who cares? You know, if we're trying to understand if we're trying to understand the physics of the black hole, you know, why should it matter if you take a quotient or not? So the geometry is locally identical. It's just a global thing. So from that standpoint, I'm not too worried about the fact that this counting required n6 to at least be 4n for some n, because it seems to me that we can undo that, or rather do it. If we start with the n6 equal to 1 case that we want, we take the quotient, get large n6, do the counting, you know, go back, take the covering space. But we haven't changed the black hole too much.
Can you set n equals to 1 altogether?
Little n.
No, capital N.
Capital N.
What goes wrong in this counting?
Yeah, the problem is that we base that on a counting of the supersymmetric four-charge black hole. And to get the formula, you know, n1, n2, n3, n4, we needed, well, at least in the supersymmetric case, as I recall, all of these charges needed to be large to justify this. Otherwise, there are corrections. Now, maybe we can get away with three of them being large and one being small. I should double check that. But
I think it's not an issue because the subtractions come from some index theorem. Here, I don't think that you have to worry about that because it's not supersymmetric. You're not really counting an index entropy. You don't count the negative part.
Yeah, we're not worrying about subleading terms here. That's
right.
Part of it. Anyway, this was the reason why I was thinking n had to be large, because we were basing the counting on this. And I thought these charges all had to be big. But maybe only some of them need to be big. So I should double check that. Okay. Well, it's 3 o'clock. So let me stop there and take further questions. Yeah, David?
So this argument at the end was just to motivate that it wasn't so bad that N6 was large.
Right.
You're not really deriving any large.
No. I mean, the actual calculations, you know, work for you know, this N here, and that's where we've sort of checked that
because I'm a little worried that the group quotient on the black hole geometry is going to be potentially meaningful. I mean, it's true that things are big, but, you know, a sphere monoclinic group has certain charges, maybe fractional value charges, which reflect that difference in topology and which ought to be measurable at some distance from the sphere. So I would think that although I sympathize with the motivation, that's not necessarily.
Okay, I certainly wasn't claiming anything rigorous or at the end. It was simply my feeling that I don't feel. If the goal is to try to get to Kerr, and I want to emphasize we're not there yet, right? I just said we're making progress. If the goal is to get to Kerr, you know, we seem to have to add some of this D6 brain charge. How much may be under a little bit of debate. It looks like you have to add a lot. Maybe you don't have to add so much, but we're not really sure. Yeah. Jim?
In 4 dimensions, there's some information about the dynamics on these black holes that come from the area increase formula, which tells us if we throw stuff in, how much the area and therefore the entropy increases.
Right.
Is there a corresponding thing in 5 dimensions? And if so, how do you expect that the increase in the area will be described in terms of a deeper image?
Okay, so there is a corresponding first law in 5 dimensions. So there's no problem. Everything extends very nicely. You have the same sort of formula that the well, in terms of the Hawking temperature, it's exactly the same because it's just thermodynamics. dm is TdS. And plus you get, in 5 dimensions, there's no charges. So I guess there's just an omega dj type rotation piece.
I'm thinking of the Rayleigh equation, where dA dS is the integral of the square of the shear plus the stuff going through.
Right. You can do that, right. That's probably equivalent. How do you describe that in this language? Well, part of the problem with answering that is that that's typically talking about non-extremal black holes. You throw something in and you make them non-extremal. Right. So the picture of the counting that I've talked about so far only works for extremal black holes. So I haven't said anywhere what happens if you go away from extremality. So right now the goal is to try to explain extremal Kerr, which seems like this good sort of first step. And then, of course, we'd like to go to non-extremal Kerr and get Schwarzschild and everything.
The question is, do you expect then to get a counting argument for non-extremal black holes?
I'm hopeful. I would certainly like to.
And what changes as you throw stuff in? Do these numbers change?
Well, there is a picture which, let me just say a word about. So in the supersymmetric case, when you have all these charges around, it was shown that you can go non-extremal if you go just a little bit. And there the story was that that rather than have an entropy, which is this 2 pi times the product of the 4 charges, which are thought of as sort of brains, you could actually show that for near-extremal black holes, this last charge could be either brains or anti-brains. Or if you realize it as momentum, it could either be right-moving or left-moving momentum. And so what the entropy became was a simple sum of the number of brains and the number of anti-brains in that simple way. And so this was derived from the black hole geometry, which already was a little surprising because you think the entropy is the area is a single square root of, you know, integrated over. But in these black holes, it actually broke up nicely into these two pieces. But then this had a simple interpretation because if you're counting states and you know you have left moving and right moving modes and they're not interacting, the entropies would just add. So this was understood. And then there was a formula, that Andy and Juan and I found by looking at Schwarzschild and general non-extremal black holes, which just generalized this into, and this was derived from the black hole geometries, N1, N1 bar, you know, N2, N2 bar, N3, N3 bar, square roots, and the same thing with the fourth one. Now, that formula had the property that gave the right entropy for any black hole, for any charges. The charges were the obvious thing. The total charge, you know, one charge was sort of N, you know, I don't know, total one, N1 minus N1 bar in the obvious way. It's same for the same things. Mm-hmm. There was also other motivation coming from looking at the stresses and tensions in the other directions. But anyway, this was a very sort of appealing formula, at least to us. And it had the property that it was all sort of duality invariant, because you know, you could do duality transformations which changed this, you know, basically permuted these indices, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so starting with this, if this was a general formula, whenever you were in a regime where there were a lot more one brains than anti-brains and two brains than anti-two brains, then you would pick up, it would reduce to that. But nobody has yet been able to derive this formula from some sort of stringy starting point. And so that's my hope, that one day we'll actually derive this as the correct formula for the entropy of any black hole.
Gary?
Yeah?
Do we find N1 bar and N1 for black hole?
It's actually uniquely defined from the 10-dimensional geometry. And all you do is you start with the individual brain solutions. And you say, OK, if I just take the one brain solution in 10 dimensions, you know, how much stress does it produce on the 6th torus? How much, you know, this sort of thing. And then you, from the full 10-dimensional solution, there's enough information to uniquely define those integers. And the mass, I didn't say this, but the mass also works out to be exactly what you would want. It's N1 plus N1 bar times the mass of the one brain plus, et cetera. So it looks like these are non-interacting constituent brains and anti-brains. Quite surprising, but you know, we don't understand it.
So, of course, you know, Schwarzschild and Kerr are both sort of universal objects, which you should be able to find in any dimension if you've compactified down to any dimension. So what are your guesses about how you might find these things up in higher dimensions? Do you think there's some sort of story there?
I certainly hope so. I don't see any difference. I don't see why we should be able to explain it in 4 dimensions and not 7. I think that...
You're resorting to the supersymmetric counting.
Yes.
We don't have
supersymmetric analogs in 7 dimensions.
We also don't have extreme Kerr in the same sense in 7 dimensions.
That's also true. That might be a problem.
Oh.
Well, if all the angular momenta are non-zero, there is no upper bound. There's no max.
If you turn everything on, then there is an upper
bound. Oh, sorry.
If you do something like that,
got it backwards.
And just set them all equal, then it'd be some simple formula.
Okay, but you're saying if you have one non-zero and the rest zero,
yeah,
then that one non-zero angular momentum can be arbitrarily big. So there's no bound.
Which is really what you did here.
Which is very. I set them equal, basically, to get this. Yeah, so I don't know. For some reason, maybe because we're starting with the supersymmetric or using the supersymmetric insight, it's easier to think about 4 and 5.
Somehow they're close to supersymmetry in some precise sense? Or?
No. No.
Yeah, it's non-supersymmetric.
These are really non-supersymmetric, even in the extremal limit, and there's no sense in which, you know, you're epsilon away from a supersymmetric configuration.
But the brain goes function is something I wanted to ask you. So in the supersymmetric case, we believe you can do the counting on the brain side and then extrapolate the strong coupling to the gravity side because of supersymmetry.
Right.
Here, it sounds like you only need this pairwise supersymmetry between the intersecting brains. So if you take all the 4 sets of brains into consideration, Susie is broken.
Right.
And then it's puzzling why this counting actually match.
Right. Although a partial answer to that, or maybe a complete answer, was given just last fall in this paper by Sen and Trivedi and Bablakar, I think. So they talked about the attractor equations for rotating black holes and showed that for extremal rotating black holes, there is still this attractor mechanism, which would mean that if you, you know, regardless of what your string coupling is at infinity, it gets, you know, fixed at some value at the horizon, sort of along with all the moduli. So I think that, well, I guess not in. Anyway, so they were arguing that that would allow you to justify some extrapolation from weak to strong coupling for this case.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to ask, how exactly did Wadi probe the stability of these D0 and D6 systems? I mean, how do you, from a gauge theory point of view on the D6 brains, how do you test for the possibility of the D0 brain hopping off the D6 brain? How do you see that?
He really just looked at the four-dimensional field theory as a classical field theory and just looked at the
six-dimensional
field theory, the U4 theory,
right.
Wrote down a perturbative expansion against this background that's just not, it's not a vacuum, and it was quadratically stable, but there were flat directions.
But how does it tell you anything about what happens when D0 is leaving the D6 brain?
Because
you can
see
it. Okay. So it's a conjecture that that's a stable
direction. The idea is that if it's going to leave the brain, it has to localize, right? So the way this would happen is that this smoothed out configuration would have to sort of localize at a point and then sort of leave the brain. And I guess he doesn't see a mode which wants it to sort of localize.
I see.
That's probably the argument.
Now, well, separate discussion
later. Okay, well, thank you.
So, a separate discussion. If I was doing